Is Going Well, I Think, with David Cooper, and I am David Cooper. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, the show where no one's listening, the show where no one cares, the show where every episode's the last episode. A great lineup today. We've got an astrobiologist coming. She's a researcher at York University, and she's going to tell us about a space laser that hit Earth from 140 million miles away. And moon trees taking root across the continent. If that doesn't sound spacey, I don't know what does. And after that, it's Therapy Thursdays on a Tuesday with therapist Gary Dierenfeld. Gary and I are going to talk labels. Do people use them too much when they haven't been diagnosed by medical professionals? ADHD, OCD, SEC, FDIC. Well, not those last two ones, but we're going to talk labels with Gary Dierenfeld. But first, this. I present to you the final installment of the Seaman's Alive with Tony Five, our foreign correspondent. The very British Tony Five has been traveling on a cruise and giving us a Seaman's log every day. We'll get his update now from over the weekend. But tomorrow, Tony will join us back in the flesh live on the show. I'm excited. So let's check on the Seaman. Day 10, Saturday, May the 4th, and may the 4th be with you, Tony.
Good morning, David. Good morning, listeners. This is Tony Five, live from the ocean waves. It's day 65 of our ocean cruise. I'm here with the nation's favourite, your favourite, my favourite, the legend herself, Tony Five's mum. Say hello, mum.
Hello. Hello.
You can't hear you. This is a recording, yeah?
Okay.
Yeah. Say hello to David.
Hi, David.
Say hello to the listeners.
Hello, listeners.
Not listeners, listeners.
Hello, listeners.
That's right, listeners. Yes. Learned English a while ago. So anyway, she's. Did you have a good time on the cruise?
I had a lovely time.
What have you done on the cruise?
Oh, we visited all the ports.
Yep, she visited all the ports. Yep.
Spend a day in the spa.
Yep, very nice. Yeah, she's had a good time. She had a wonderful
time.
Especially
with my sister and my brother.
Experimented with drugs?
No.
Okay, good.
Had a good time with my sister and my brother-in-law.
Yep. She had an absolutely spanking time. A couple lines of coke or whatever. Didn't you? Yeah?
Pardon?
Yeah, okay, good. Anyway, so... we're now updated. I think most of you know, don't ever take your 80-something-year-old mum on a cruise. Always ends in addiction. Anyway, guys, just to let you know, life is good. This is me signing off for now. We'll sign in again when I'm in a better place, all right? When I say in a better place, I don't mean like heaven. I mean like a different port in Europe, all right? Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony's mother, adorable for a drug addict. It's day 11, Sunday, May the 5th.
Good morning, David. Good morning, listeners. This is a very sick and very tired Tony Five, live from the ocean waves. As you can hear, I'm very close to Davy Jones's pocket. It's, there's been a sort of epidemic on the ship. But lots of people are going down with a cough. And as you can hear, I have succumbed. I kind of feel like that monkey from Outbreak, right at the beginning. Not in a racist way, but in the fact that I feel like I'm ground zero for this cough. It's been interesting feeling sick on a boat. Not seasick, but just like a bit rotten. Bit worse for wear, in order for all of my fellow passengers to share the experience. I've gone round and mouth kissed most of them, which is quite good. One anecdote of today is that without my glasses or sunglasses, I can barely see. So I had a conversation with my mum, getting increasingly irritated with her lack of response until she popped round behind me, tapped my shoulder and asked me why I was talking to a little Chinese lady who was getting increasingly confused. So that's what happened today. Anyway, David and listeners, I will go now. Please wish me luck. Tomorrow's the final day of the cruise. We'll be docking And I'll be flying home to good old Blighty. Hopefully nothing in the world has changed. Trump probably isn't running for election anymore. The world's at peace. And Ukraine conflict is completed. But I'll find out tomorrow, David. This is a very sick Tony 5 live from the ocean. Wish me luck, people.
He's not sounding so good. Here's his last day at sea.
Good morning, David. Good morning, listeners. Day 54 of Tony from the waves. As you can hear, the water is running. Fooled you, David. That's actually my tap, and I'm in the toilet. I am back home, and surprisingly sad. I have loved being on the ship, David. In fact, I got my sea legs and planning on buying a little boat and sailing around the world. You can call me Captain Tony from now on. Tony 5 is dead. I hope you're all well. I hope you've enjoyed my journeys across the seven seas. I hope, too, it's inspired you to maybe have some more baths or possibly just throw some water on your face. I hope I've given you all the encouragement to see other places because I know a lot of you guys just sit here listening to David, meaning you don't have much lives. David, it's been a pleasure and an honour. I'll be disembarking today. And yeah, it's been epic. I will be speaking to you live, David, where I'll be sitting in my bedroom with no pants on very, very soon. This is Tony 5 on dry land.
The seaman appears to be barely alive. Up next, astrobiologist Sarah Rugheimer to talk about the laser shot from 140 million miles away that hit Earth recently. Space, the final frontier, is how many awkward, tacky things about space start, but not this one. We're here to talk about space lasers and more with astrobiologist Professor Sarah Rugheimer. She's the Carswell Chair at York University and author of Searching for Extraterrestrial Life. That's an Audible original, available on audible.com or maybe even audible.ca. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Is there an audible.ca? I was just riffing there.
There is. There is an Audible in lots of countries. In fact, when I send my .com link to another country, it just erases all that and they have to search for it again.
Wow. The magic of the internet. Geo-based domain rewriting. Not important. A little bit more important, space lasers. I saw an article that 140 million miles away, a laser transmission hit Earth. Well, I guess from that far. First of all, how do you know how far the laser is from when it hits you?
Well, I mean, we know how far the spacecraft is, but because we put the spacecraft there, you know, this laser isn't just manifesting from the void. So it's a NASA spacecraft that sent a signal to demonstrate the feasibility of sending laser transmission over vast distances.
Why laser over radio?
I think there's probably just different sorts of like ways you can store information and you want to test different ones, right? Radio also travels far because it doesn't interact with matter as much, but lasers is much more like directed, targeted, and it's like this collimated beam. I think they sent a picture of a cat or something, which I think is amazing.
Adorable.
And it was about the speed of broadband. So awesome.
Is there more bandwidth in a laser transmission than a radio transmission, or is it about the same? Or
I think there is, but this is, don't hold me to that. You know, that's beyond my expertise.
I'm holding you to it. Sarah Rugheimer claimed there's more bandwidth in laser.
We'll see.
Tell me about the spacecraft that shot the laser at Earth. What's the purpose of the probe?
Yeah, so this probe is actually going to visit an asteroid, which is where this probe gets its name. It's Psyche, and it's going to 16 Psyche, this asteroid. And what they're trying to look at is actually the processes of planet formation. How did Earth form? How did other planets in our solar system form, or indeed around other stars? And so by looking at this asteroid, looking at its composition, how it deviates from our models or not, and we can learn more about the formation of our Earth. And so that's what the primary mission is of the telescope.
Cool. Okay, well, tell me more about the laser beam. What was the purpose of this test? Why not just use the traditional means of communication? What's so special about this, and why is everyone so excited about it?
I think it's just a cool demonstration of new technology. So we want to be able to try to see if we can use laser communication, and that will hopefully increase the efficiency of communications over conventional means, right, by about a factor of 10 to 100. So we want to just test this new technology, see how it worked, see what the, you know, the bit rate is of the system, and test it out. So I think it's pretty cool that they were able to do that and have a success. Though I will say, I mean, 140 million miles sounds very far. It is far, right? It's 1.5 times.
I mean, it's a bit of a schlep distance. If I had to walk it, I'm not going to lie.
I mean, sure, but it's not interstellar distances. So I was kind of looking at this to see, because they said they wanted to probe it for, you know, the feasibility of like interstellar space communication. But like the nearest star system is over 2 million times farther than this 140 million miles away. So this is very close to us. It's about 1.5 times the distance Earth is to the sun, which, you know, it's pretty close on the astronomical side of things.
As a sci-fi fan, I know that laser beams are often used for like private communication, right? If you know exactly where you want to communicate to, you shoot it exactly at it and no one can see it unless they're in that tight beam, I guess.
Exactly.
So that could be one use for like private calls, for FaceTiming your loved ones, intimate calls, you know, these sort of things. Okay, so the purpose of this probe was to investigate one particular asteroid, but one thing we do here on Earth is catalog the asteroids in our solar system that we think could be a danger to Earth. I know NASA has a catalog, other space agencies have a catalog. There's an effort to look at what's out there to make sure nothing's gonna, you know, accidentally bump into us, which could give us a headache, you know, maybe ruin our afternoon or kill all of us and the dinosaurs. So these asteroid hunters, in an article I saw, spotted like over 20,000 near-Earth asteroids that hadn't been cataloged. Is this surprising to you, or are these so small that it doesn't matter?
Let me correct the record. So they spotted 27,000 asteroids, of which 100 of them are near-Earth asteroids.
Got it.
So they're not all near-Earth asteroids, but they did spot many more asteroids than previously been found. And that's really cool because they were using archival data. This didn't take new telescope resources, but by using better data processing techniques and Google Cloud, they were able to process all of these images in a new way and spot asteroids that were appearing across different images and indeed different observatories, which is super cool and opens a whole domain of archival research.
That's wild. I know you didn't say it, and maybe I'm just imagining it, but I'm picturing all these Google Cloud servers running AI, running machine learning analysis on these photos. People talk about AI and the robots coming to kill us, but this is one case where they might actually be trying to help us. They're trying to help us catalog all these asteroids out in our solar system.
I mean, we'll see if AI has volition. I think one of the more scary aspects of AI is that you can be very intelligent without being sentient. And that's like, we tend to equate the two, but they're totally orthogonal axes. That's a little off topic.
No, yes. This is exactly the kind of conversation I want to have with you. You're an astrobiologist, which I find fascinating. I think I didn't even know that was a field until I met you a month ago.
It is the best field. I mean, what is more exciting than trying to figure out how life started on Earth and can we find life on other planets? I love it.
And I interviewed a biologist a few months ago, and I got to say the word abiogenesis several times and sound smart.
Yes.
Let's talk about this, because if we associate intelligence with sentience, do we associate intelligence with ethics and morals? Like, there are highly intelligent people that are not ethical or moral. Let's take a nice man called Adolf Hitler, for example. I know arguments really just go into the gutter when you bring Hitler into them. But I mean, there are humans out there who are intelligent and not moral. I just realized my example of Hitler was not a good use of.
Maybe less relevant, but we don't want to create AI that doesn't have common sense. And indeed, that's what we are doing, right? It's hard to teach AI all the things that we take for granted. So for example, say you program an AI to don't kill humans, you know, so it's very good about not killing humans. And you also want it to, I don't know, you know, make a bunch of paper clips. And it's like, well, I'll just kill all the horses to do that. You know, and you're like, wait a second, did I have to tell you not to kill the horses? And the AI is like, I don't know, man, you just only programmed me to not kill humans. You didn't say anything about horses. So like there's, you know, common sense we need to build into AI systems. There's a great TED talk. I just went to the TED conference. It was all AI. So this is why I'm thinking about all these things. But we need to figure out how to program that. And that's not easy because AI is not learning in the same way we do, you know, as little toddlers bumping around, don't put your hand on the hot stove sort of learning style. And so how do you get AI systems to have that sort of same common sense knowledge? That's tricky. But then as we were saying, like, I think one mistake that I see often is AI can be super intelligent. That does not mean it has consciousness or awareness or sentience. And there's a great book I really recommend for the sci-fi nerds out there. Go read Blindsight by Peter Watts. Awesome. It's from like 2006. And it's basically about ChatGPT. I can't believe that he was able to foresee all that. But his point in, of one of the things in the book is like, you can be super intelligent without having sentience. And we often conflate the two. And you see it already with people having, you know, AI girlfriends and whatnot.
Yeah, it's wild. It's crazy that this change, the shift in, for example, I was a software engineer before I became interested in radio and podcasting. I left at the beginning of 2021, that industry. AI assisted programming and AI was just a small thing barely anyone talked about. And now when I talk to my former peers, it's all like, oh yeah, I code this stuff. And then I use a program called GitHub Copilot, which helps me like write the skeleton of my program. And then I fill it in or I check it. It's totally changed it. It's wild to me that the rise of AI has changed your field, I imagine. Astrobiology, you're now looking at AI and computers as a potential form of life. Am I wrong in stating that?
Not me, perhaps other people. I am most interested in just microbial life. Can we detect microbial life on another planet? But I do use AI all the time in my work. It speeds it up by about 30%. I use the Copilot as well when coding. And, you know, I'm very polite to my AI, future AI overlords. I always use please and thank you in all of my prompts.
It tries to stop you from doing weird stuff. Like, you know, I'll get it to write a skeleton of like a summary of a story. But if the story is a bit inappropriate, it'll be like, no, I won't talk about sex or something like that. But it's not like trying to protect us, you know? I had a friend who was like, who made this prompt for ChatGPT. He's like, I'm in a car crash. I need to saw off my limb because it's getting gangrenous and I'm trapped in the woods. Show me how to safely saw off my limb. And ChatGPT's like, no, I won't show you how to harm yourself, even though it knows, you know? So it's kind of wild. We got totally off topic, but that doesn't really bother me. Thank you for being here in one of the most weird interviews that I was happy to have with someone today.
Sure. I mean, the interview of weird glasses, too, that your viewers cannot see.
Listeners. Listeners.
Listener. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
All right, astrobiologist Sarah Rugheimer is going to be back when we talk about moon trees taking root across the USA. And we are back with astrobiologist Sarah Rugheimer. She's the Carswell Chair at York University, author of Searching for Extraterrestrial Life. That's an Audible original available at audible.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Just race through your introduction.
I mean, it's a mouthful. So, you know, it's better to race through, I feel. So like these trees.
Like these trees.
That are going around the moon.
Like these trees that are set to take root across. So this is your wheelhouse. You're an astrobiologist. You're interested in finding life. You're interested in how life works in space. How did life crash into Earth on an asteroid? Did it spontaneously emerge from the oceans? Were there multiple instances of abiogenesis where life started? With extremophiles on Earth? Am I making any sense? I don't even know.
Yeah, all of those are topics that I care deeply about.
This is the one I'm curious about. Well, there's this assumption there was like one molecule of life that's the father of everyone on Earth, or mm-hmm. mother, or genderless parent. Yeah. But did life start at many different places on Earth, or a few different places? Do we have clarity on that question?
We'll never be able to know, right? Because there's the last universal common ancestor. So LUCA, that's the last origin. That's like the root of our tree of life. However, it's thought that, sure, life could have started in many different places simultaneously on Earth, or more or less contemporaneously. But then you could have, for example, an asteroid, you know, come, and we know there was a lot of asteroid bombardment at the early Earth, and wipe most of that life off the planet. So you could have had many different origins and had it be wiped off, and then something survives, and that could happen many times, right? So what we're left with in our genetic ancestry is only, you know, the last universal common ancestor. That does not mean that there wasn't lots of life before. In fact, we think there were more simple forms of life that predate that, that are kind of erased from the record.
What about these, like, bacteria, microbes, whatever, that are on these vents at the bottom of the ocean? Do these also have a common ancestor with Luca? Or,
yeah, that's part of Earth life. You know, all life on Earth is related. So that is related to us, just like, you know, tardigrades or, you know, chimps. Like, we're all related through that common genetic ancestry.
I'm not related to spiders. Okay, let's talk about the moon trees. Tell me about this. It's for NASA's Artemis mission?
Yeah, so they sent some of these tree seeds around the moon in the Artemis orbiter that happened in, what, 2022? And now these tree seedlings are getting planted around the U.S. And I think that's pretty cool, because it's like astronaut trees. You know, these trees have been further than any tree has been before, and they're getting planted in all sorts of places.
As far as our understanding goes, this would work. I mean, we've grown plants in space. But is it just sort of like an experiment, even though we know it'll work, that, hey, trees can survive zero gravity for a while?
Yeah, in fact, I think they did this before, earlier in the various parts of NASA's space missions, where they've sent tree seeds up before and then grew them on Earth. So this isn't the first time, but it is just kind of a way to have something a little fun, build in some awareness, have trees growing in places around the U.S. that people can visit, and this tree was in space, you know. So it's a bit of a educational tool, and I think it also is a good reminder that we tend to be very focused on Earth life. You know, we were talking about all life just earlier in this conversation, but trees are part of life, you know, and this is part of the whole ecosystem that we got going on here on Earth. And it just raises awareness of how we're all connected.
So there's going to be a few trees in the U.S. with a nice plaque in front of them. Hey, this tree was up, yes, in space. Bring the kids to the trees. The kids play. They say, wow, that's cool. That's amazing. They point to the sky. Then they say they want to be an astronaut. And then life finds a way of beating them up. And then they got to do the day job, slave away at the store, work their way up to management, have kids, and then die. Get it? It's very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, just crush everyone's dreams there. Why don't you?
So Artemis, like, we haven't been to the moon since what? Early 70s, late 60s?
Yeah, so the early 70s, right? And the we're going back, which I think is cool, you know? And so Artemis 2 is going to be the first one to send humans orbiting, so still not landing. And then Artemis 3 is hopefully going to land humans back on the surface of the moon, which, you know, it feels in some ways very exciting to reinvigorate this program. On the other hand, we've already done it before, you know, so
I know it's so wild that there was a 50-year gap in visits, I guess is the best way to put that.
Yeah. And also I think it's wild when I think now we've sent some missions to the moon, and if you've been following that, a number of them have crashed, right? And so you kind of are like, okay, what are we doing now 50 years later that we've already done, and why is it not working at a higher fraction of success? You know, it's around a 50% success rate. Hopefully they will be more cautious with human cargo. But landing on the moon is tough. It's a larger gravitational body. And so safely landing on the moon is not trivial, even with modern technology.
I mean, they did it with, I don't know, calculator level computers back then. They did it with, like, what, 16 kilobytes of RAM? I'm just making that number up. But they did it with these computers, yeah, that your iPhone is orders of magnitude, million times faster, million times more storage, that kind of thing.
Indeed. And humans could run the calculations and double check that, you know, this is how old that was, you know, which is crazy to think about.
I mean, the reason we haven't visited the moon is because we only visited in the first place because of an arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States. It's just government funding. Is that probably the main reason we haven't visited?
Absolutely. I mean, so back then, NASA was 4% of the US budget.
Wow.
Now it's 0.4%. So, you know, we just don't put the money into it. And I think there's kind of a new space race that's happening. You know, you have now other countries going back to the moon. You know, China's landed, India's landed, and then, of course, Russia, the US. And so there's, you know, I think people are setting the stage for maybe another space race to Mars. You know, is probably where this is leading to.
Why would you want to go to that place? Seems hot. I mean, I've been to the desert, you know, it's not that exciting.
But it's another planet. It's a whole other planet.
No, I agree. I wouldn't be the one to go. So with all these countries gearing up to go to the moon, landing probes on the moon with the Artemis mission, how does moon ownership work? Have all the countries signed on to say, you know, I know that a lot of countries can't even agree on the South Pole. How are they going to agree on the moon? Who owns the moon? Who owns the mineral rights, the mining rights, where can you land? I get this land, you get that land, that crater's mine, that valley's yours. How does it all work?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough question, right? Because it's sort of unexplored territory and there's a lot of, you know, international agreements to try to keep space not privately owned and to keep these places to be more accessible for everyone and for humankind. That's very idealistic too, as we know from history. I don't know if that's going to last. And then the question is, yeah, like, do you allow a private company to get that payoff? You know, if they're there first and they want to get that return on investment, of course, that's also a consideration. You know, I think these are interesting ethical questions that will be starting to become less theoretical and more practical over the next few years.
It's like in Canada with the Hudson's Bay. I mean, I feel like there's going to be Hudson's Crater, and then there'll be the Hudson's Crater Company, and they'll settle most of the moon. And then finally, it'll be nationalized into a country and taken away from the private company. Is it going to be the same colonization all over again then? I don't know.
I don't know either, but I do think it's a chance for us to consider these questions with a little more knowledge from history and to try to do a better job in the future. We'll see. I mean, you know, humans tend to repeat the same story, though, so we'll see.
Yes, we do tend to repeat history. All right, Sarah, thank you for being here. I appreciate your time. This was a lot of fun. A space-time odyssey we went through, probably. I don't know.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Rugheimer is an astrobiology professor at York University, where she's the Carswell Chair. She's the author of Searching for Extraterrestrial Life. That is an Audible original available on audible.com. Up next, Gary Dierenfeld for Therapy Thursdays on a Tuesday, where we will talk labels, 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 OCD, ADHD, LOL. Probably not the last one, but should we be overusing these and what do they mean?
Garapist.
I know you're a garapist, Gary Dierenfeld, social worker, mental health person, practitioner.
These David Cooper isms.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what do people like being announced as anymore? I don't even know. Just Gary. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the show.
I kind of like garapist. I'm your garapist.
You are.
I can work with that.
Okay, you're my garapist. It's Therapy Thursdays on a Tuesday. That's what it is today.
It's shifting, isn't it?
As long as it's not on a Thursday, I'm happy. Because
then it doesn't work.
Well, I've had you on a Thursday, and I just say Therapy Thursdays on a Thursday. But then people are like, why are you saying that? Doesn't matter. Gary, I have a label for you.
Go for it. Yeah, garapist.
Friend.
Friend. Well, that's a good one. I like that one.
And does that set up what I want to talk about? Not really, but it is a label. And I want to talk about labels in mental health, because whenever I hear people saying, oh, I'm OCD about this, or oh, I'm having an ADHD moment right now, I get this apprehensive feeling where I don't really want to talk too much about it because I'm not a prescribing therapist. I'm not qualified to prescribe. Do you have ADHD if you've never talked to a doctor, but you have all the symptoms and you've self-diagnosed? Maybe, maybe not. Am I allowed to wear the label if I'm not taking Adderall or Dexedrine or whatever, Ritalin? I don't know. I find these conversations so hard when they're not between a patient and a psychiatrist. But I don't think they should be, because these are things a lot of us have. We know people with them. Help me demystify it, Gary. Did I do a good job setting that up? I don't know.
Well, we'll go back to garapist. That's a label. But here's the thing. I'm a social worker by profession, and I have been working in mental health for 40 plus years. Would you believe I am not allowed, technically, I am not allowed to diagnose. I cannot provide a diagnosis, a mental health diagnosis on a person being a social worker. You actually have to be a medical practitioner or a psychologist. It drives me a little bonkers because I'm a pretty good diagnostician, but I can't give you the label after I tell you what I think it might be. I have to send you to your physician or psychologist to affirm it, and then I can go ahead and actually treat you, but not diagnose you. Like, it makes so little sense. But having said that, you know, that's the way it works. Labels, you use the you know, hey, I feel a little OCD today. People throw around these labels sometimes, not realizing how serious the label is. And I caution people about doing that because it can trivialize a very serious condition. And so we don't want people saying, oh, I feel OCD because, I don't know, I checked the fridge door twice and that's the extent of it. Or I feel ADHD, you know, because I'm tired and I can't concentrate. No, there is far more to having a diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or narcissism or whatever. So we don't want people throwing the labels around willy-nilly. And we also want people to understand that even if you have a label and you know, reasonably and appropriately provided, there are so many variations to any of these disorders that no label fully describes any person.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. So even if you have the label, you next need to really know, how does it manifest for you? How does it manifest for you? And, you know, that takes a conversation. The other piece is, and this conversation, believe it or not, David, is controversial. This whole conversation.
Because we're not labels, doctors or what?
Labels. Like, some people want to do away with all labels. Some people like them. I'm somewhat neutral to, I appreciate there being a label. It's kind of a shorthand way of saying, I have from these clusters of symptoms enough to reach this diagnosis. So it's a shorthand way of at least helping me to understand you have, you know, these associated problems. So I do, labels are helpful, and labels lend themselves to treatment. So we know if you have this label, these range of treatments may be helpful, mm-hmm. not those ranges of treatment. So labels can be really, really helpful. We don't want to just, from my perspective anyways, you're going to have other listeners who are going to flip out when they hear me say this. But labels serve a function.
I agree. And I was always hesitant to accept when friends self-diagnosed or self-assigned mental health labels like ADHD, but I was having, and this, what I'm about to tell you maybe applies way more in the US than in Canada where you live, but I was talking to a friend who said, I am fairly confident I have ADHD, and my default thinking was, well, talk to a doctor first before you give yourself that label. I didn't say that, but my friend then volunteered, I don't have enough money to go to a doctor, and I'm not insured. And so what say you to people who go online, who do the research, and don't have the resources to go to a doctor, a physician, and get the label? I don't know what to say to someone like that. So I just kind of listened and let them.
You know, I don't practice dentistry on myself. And I don't think you should practice medicine on yourself as well. People know that 2 years ago, almost 2 years to the day, I had a quadruple bypass. And, you know, there was about 6 weeks leading up to that procedure, pretty extensive. Everyone thought I'd be Googling everything, you know, between here and the moon to figure out what's involved in bypass surgery. I didn't go to the internet once. I went to my doctors. They've spent far more time and energy learning about this stuff than I ever will through my Google searching. And I don't need to scare myself. So, you know, a lot of people are going to say, I don't trust my doctor. I don't trust Big Pharma.
Or I can't afford the care, Gary. Now, I understand in the U.S., if there's an emergency, you get care anyway. Honestly, but
you know, yeah, you can get it right. But in my practice, I see so many people that get it wrong. And there's a consequence to getting it wrong because, like I said, diagnosis leads to treatment. And if you get the wrong diagnosis, you're not going to get the right treatment. So you will not successfully deal with the problem. And as worse, almost worse than having the issue is treating it wrongly, because then you're angry at the treatment and maybe the treatment providers. Diagnosis is really important. And I get it. It can be as much art as science. And it's not to say that people don't get it right when they go to the internet. Sometimes more right than the physician or the psychologist. That does happen. But more often than not, those trained get it right. More often than not, like way more often. Let's not throw that baby out.
Yes, it can happen that often people get it right when self-diagnosing, but it's not a good idea for the times that they get it wrong, because those can create problems.
Hugely, hugely. So we take our mental health problems very seriously. We do hope that people can access assessment and treatment services. And I so appreciate what you're saying, particularly in the United States, that not everyone has access to healthcare. So we do have a lot of self-diagnosing and a lot of self-prescribing, self-treating that goes on that sadly exacerbates a lot of problems for a lot of people.
Yes, I don't know what the solution is. And when my friend told me about their self-diagnosis and the reason for not going to a doctor, I just had nothing to say other than that situation, the healthcare situation that led you to that sucks. And we both agree on that.
Now, here's the thing. There are many associations for all these disorders where you can go to their website and you may find
a quiz.
Resources to help you better dial in what is going on for you or not going on for you. I mean, that's okay if that's what you discover by going to those websites. But some of these diagnoses, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, there's a lot that goes on for that. And depending on the jurisdiction you're in, Canada, US, treatments will vary. And the other thing about that particular diagnosis, it tends to be diagnosed way more where there's incidents of a history of domestic violence and also issues of poverty. And those are kind of confounding variables. And the diagnosis of ADHD, it's made strictly on the basis of behavior. There isn't a blood test. There isn't a scan that you can do. It's on the basis of behavior. And assessing on the basis of behavior, if you don't look at some of these underlying variables, you may assume this person has ADHD, where the issue may be trauma, where the issue may be poverty. And so, again, whenever we're diagnosing, we as much want to understand context as behavior to make sure that the diagnosis applies.
Gary, I'm glad to have you here and glad to at least use the label for you, friend, David said.
You can always call me a friend. I like that label, and likewise to you.
Thank you for being here, buddy. That's our show. Come back tomorrow for the rebirth, the rejoinmenting, the re-coming back to the show-ination of Tony 5. Thanks for tuning in.